And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we've got a great show. It's free for everybody, 2 hours long. I'll get into that in just a minute. Alejandro Rojas is coming up with the news shortly. But first of all, I want to talk about the GetJoyride.com platform. They were bought by Google, and for some reason, Google does not want to keep it going, so that is being shut down at the end of this month. And so because of that, I'm giving out free shows until I have an alternative plan as far as subscribing for the second part of the show. And we have a listener who is going to help out, and his name is Sam Bosell. And I am very grateful to him for he's going to show us a way on how to do it. And so another little bit of housekeeping is I'm going to be off. I'm taking my first vacation since I started the show back in 2011, and I'm going to over to Russia for a couple of weeks, and I am not going to be able to do the show from there. Next week, we have a pre-recorded show, and it's a great one, and it's all ready. It's in the can, ready to go. We have Dr. Eric Farouk. He's going to be talking about UFO trace evidence that he was trying to get taken serious by the scientific community and get it published, but no one took him seriously. He then wrote a book. He's a great interview. He's in the UK. And secondly, one of my all-time favorites, we'll have Klaus Svahn. He is the director of international research and of the Sweden UFO. Great guy. He'll be on. So that's coming up next week. Again, this week we have Mark O'Connell. He's written Star Trek episodes, one of the ones that were in the top 100 of all episodes. And he also has HighStrangenessUFO.com. It's going to be a great guest coming up for the full 2 hours. And I want to thank everyone that has been supporting the show. And hold tight. We'll be back with some other type of platform. And that's enough of me babbling. How are you, Alejandro? How was your holiday weekend?
It was wonderful. I am wonderful because of it.
That remains to be seen, by the way. We'll see.
I think so. I am pretty sure that everyone will agree. I was on the beach in San Diego. The weather was great. I jumped around in the waves. I flew a kite. I just had a lot of fun.
Right. When is the weather not good? I mean, every time I've ever been to San Diego, it's been, like, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I know rain in the winter, but I hope they do soon.
Yeah. Last time we were there, they got a little bit of rain. Because I was there only, like, about a month ago where I spent the week. I actually got to hang out with Ben Hansen, my friend, for a day, and But this time was a short trip. You know, it's only like a five-hour drive, so we try to get there often. But the weather, what was funny is it just so happened that one of my coworkers, it was her, she spent a week out there as well. When we got back, I was talking about how wonderful it was, and she's like, "Oh, it was so hot, it's miserable." And I'm like, "Are you kidding? We're from Arizona." I didn't feel hot at all, so sometimes people say it was a little hot. I didn't see it. So every time I've been out there, the weather is phenomenal, and it's a lot of fun. And so I absolutely had a blast.
Yep. One of my favorite places.
One of your favorite places, San Diego?
Yeah, that whole area is just beautiful. Yep. Mm.
But I wanted to tell you about Russia.
Oh, okay.
When you go out there, just because I'm not sure if you're aware of all the politics going on, but I think it would be best if you not share any state secrets.
Oh, Okay. I'll keep
because the Cold War is supposed to be over, but there's tensions. It's not really over. You know, there's a lot of tension going on. We've got these tariffs and things going on. It's very tense relations, and just don't get too comfortable. Watch your back. Hopefully everything will be fine, but you might have one of these 2010, like the movie situations where, you know, you're in Russia and then things go really bad.
Yeah, there's so many people predicting. You hear it on all over, you know, on different shows how I think, you know, mid-September there's going to be this major meltdown and asteroids coming at the end of the month. So, and I'm going to be there from the basically from the 15th through the 30th. So mm-hmm. I'm going to be there when the asteroids hit and when the economic meltdown happens.
Oh, yeah, all of that junk. I'm not so sure about all of that.
Well,
but, you know, there could be some curse words exchanged over the telephone between Obama and Putin, and that could upset people. But if Putin, you know, really gets huffy and, you know, he decides to keep you as a hostage or something, my advice, I think he seems like the type of person that flattery goes everywhere with him. You know, it's one of those things, tell him how great his muscles are, how great he's looking, what a great job he's doing, and you'll probably be okay.
Say, you're way too sexy for your shirt or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He'll be like, oh, really? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'll keep that in mind. I
just some advice.
I don't get stuck living at the airport or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, anyway, so let's move into the UFO news for this week.
UFOs. So I wanted to give an update because I did write a story before I left to San Diego with an update on the Homeland Security UFO stuff. And I wanted to get this out there. I was waiting, actually, because I didn't even include this in the story, and I really should have. But I did email Customs and Border Patrol, the local PR guy, and he said, okay, yeah, let me get you a statement. Never heard back from him, emailed him, and they said, hey, are you still getting me a statement? Haven't heard anything. So I was surprised I heard from him at all, but it seems they're not willing to share any information about this video. However, I have heard from – we've heard from a couple people. So we've alluded to this and that there's this Aeronautical and Astronautical Association in France called 3AF. We've talked to them about them before and about how they assist the French UFO organization and also the Chilean organization, CEFA-A, in investigating UFOs. They did get back with these guys, the Society or the the Scientific Coalition for Ufology, the guys who investigated the Puerto Rico video, and they said that they liked their findings. They thought they did a great job with the report, and they also don't have an explanation. And then Billy Cox talked with Dr. Richard Haynes, who used to be a NASA research scientist and who also investigates UFOs. He doesn't like the term UFOs. He doesn't use it. He uses the term anomalous phenomenon. And he runs a group called NARCAP that look at this whole thing about more from the perspective of air safety. But he liked the video, too, in the investigation. He doesn't know what it was, and he thinks it deserves more research as well. And so those are some of the experts, you know, that have communicated or given an opinion. There's also another one that I've been in touch with and has been in touch with a group. He doesn't want to use his last name or his position or the company he works for, at least, and because he's afraid of his career getting affected. And he works with a whole group of guys that are FLIR technicians. They work on the exact systems that, you know, took this video. He says he's viewed thousands of hours of live and recorded video. And him and his buddies don't know what the heck this is either in this video. In fact, he says they discussed this video quite a bit in the office. None of them, unfortunately, are brave enough to come forward because they say it could, you know, negatively hurt their career. But I did ask him about some of the responses out there, such as Mark D'Antonio, MUFON's photo and video analyst, that perhaps the object was a balloon. He thinks they measured their speed wrong. But this expert says there's no way it's a balloon. It's too hot. So in other words, the object's very dark. And the other objects in the video that are hot are also dark. That's the whole thermal imaging thing and how it works. So he says it's definitely not a balloon. It doesn't move like balloons that he's seen, and it's too hot. So he didn't believe it to be a balloon. The other person who had a theory is Chris Pajani. She's a paranormal researcher, and she has a site called You Debunked It. So she believed she debunked this video and was able to see that it was a bird. And various reasons. She thought, again, like Mark, that they got the speed calculations wrong. But she says you can see flapping. And she had some other things that she pointed out. Again, though, this Dave, the expert, says he does agree with her about some of her points about the calculations with speed. He doesn't think it's possible to be precise about how fast this object was going. However, he says he still doesn't believe it's a bird. He says you definitely would have seen the wings. He sent me a picture of some birds. You can see where their shape is very apparent, and it's not, their wings are not cooler than the body. You know, there isn't a great difference in temperature, so you can't see the entire body of the birds. But he puts in other aspects, such as the movement of the object, that show it's not a bird, because birds fly in a particular way, and this thing moves steadily along. So he just says him and his buddies at the shop, they say they know these sort of systems better than anybody. And it's not, you know, anything that they've seen before. And I was able to verify, by the way, Dave, I do know his last name. I was able to verify he is who he is. I've seen his resume. I've found him referenced online. And this guy really is an expert. He is the type of person who, in fact, the level of expertise he's rated at is kind of a level where this is the kind of guy that could build his own system. He's just that much of an expert. So, so yeah, really interesting stuff. So it you know, the debate goes on, and I think what's great is people like Dr. Haynes and the 3AF and this FLIR expert are coming in, and it's just rare because we don't always have expert opinion. Often it's online, you know, researchers, amateurs, for lack of a better word, not to disparage their work, because a lot of people do some great work, but usually we have amateurs. It's great to have some experts actually looking into this stuff and giving some responses. So exciting.
It is, and it will be fun to just see where this thing goes. I mean, we've been talking about it for a while. It's really quite amazing, and I can't personally see anything about a bird in that myself, but I understand about the speed part of it because of the way the maneuvering was happening. It would be awful hard to actually calculate the speed, I think.
Yeah, and that's what Dave says. It would be very difficult. However, you know, if you read the report, the section where they did calculate the speed, it's some very interesting work they did there, and they do thoroughly, you know, demonstrate how they determine speed. But even if they are off, doesn't appear as though they're off much, but it's difficult to say. But yeah, really interesting, like you said. And, you know, if this is, you know, what it is, if nobody is able to come up with any arguments against their findings, still, it might not go anywhere. I mean, Robert Powell, who is a part of this group, he did the radar report of the Stephenville UFO sighting, which is never, after years, it has not been disputed. Then you have cases like Chicago O'Hare, another great case that's fairly recent. But, you know, no, you just, it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, we all know about it. We learn about it. People talk about it periodically as a great case. But that's about it.
Speaking of O'Hare, I am waiting for the day that someone that worked at that airport that saw that, that changed their career and, you know, are doing something else, will come forward and actually talk about that. All those people were anonymous in that, and I would love if someone would actually come forward. Maybe they have no interest in doing that, but hopefully someone will.
It would be great if they did. It was only 7 years ago, so I think, you know, pretty much when you're in that career, you're there for your career. So it might just take someone retiring. But then again, you know, not to be, well, to be cynical, and I don't mean to be cynical, but unfortunately we see this ever so often. You know, someone could retire, and then we have a situation like we've seen before where someone retires and they're really old and they finally come forward, but they say, oh, yeah, that was an alien, and the aliens landed, and I checked the aliens' baggage, so I know those are aliens. And then, you know, they exaggerate and add stuff, which just hurts the credibility of the whole story. So
yeah,
we'll see what happens. Hopefully someone does come forward.
You know what I realized? We have talked as long as we usually do for our news. I can't believe it. Yeah.
Can I keep going now?
Oh, yeah, let's go.
I'll be quick.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. All right. Next story. Well, the next story is Exeter, which is not a new story. It's an old story. In fact, it's a 50-year-old story. It happened in 1965. But the anniversary was just in September 3rd. And we had a great story written by an author named Eric Hoffman submitted to the website. He's written for us before, and he did a great job of telling in a concise manner the story of the Exeter sighting and the investigation. So I just wanted to remember it here. There was also last weekend a festival near you that unfortunately I know you didn't make it to, but that memorializes the event. But this is a great case, and just for those who don't know much about it. This happened in Exeter, New Hampshire. It started when this young man, Norman Muscalero, was hitchhiking home after seeing his girlfriend. He had recently graduated from high school. It was the middle of the night. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And he was going to join the Navy, so he's going into the service soon. So he had seen, you know, his girlfriend in Amesbury, Massachusetts, was on his way home, hitchhiking his way home. But he was walking at this point, when at 2 a.m., he saw these five bright red lights flashing in the woods, and they started moving towards him. He was so frightened, he jumped into a ditch. At that point, you know, he noticed they eventually moved further away from him. So he ran to this nearby farmhouse and knocked on the door, but nobody was home. He then saw somebody in the street, so he runs to the street, stops the car, makes them let him in the car and tells them to drive him to the police station. When he gets to the police station, he talks to an officer, Reginald Tolan, who knows Muscalero and you know, knew him as an honest young man with high integrity. So he took him seriously. He got on the radio and called the other officers and said, hey, does anybody know anything about this weird report? There's a man named Eugene Bertrand, another officer who was in the area, and he said, you know, some woman had reported to him that she witnessed a huge object with red flashing lights that followed her car for 12 miles. So Bertrand comes into the police station, picks up Muscalero, and they go investigate where Muscalero had seen the UFO. When they get there, sure enough, they see this gigantic triangular craft coming out of the forest, and it had red flashing lights on it. Bertrand was so freaked out, he pulled his gun. I guess it was just instinct he had. But he reholstered it and said, let's get in the car. And they got back in the car, and they waited there while this thing hovered over them. They called for backup, and a man, an officer, David Hunt, came to the scene. He also saw the object, and soon after Hunt came to the scene, it slowly flew off over the woods until it was out of sight. So a really interesting sighting by police officers and everything. There was a very thorough investigation, and Hoffman does a great job summarizing that investigation. But essentially, you know, the Air Force came up with a lot of excuses. There's a book, couple books written about it. Raymond Fowler investigated it and wrote a book about it. So, but essentially, you know, they felt that all of the explanations fell through. In fact, at one point, the Air Force said, okay, you know, it's not what we said it was. You know, we know it, we know that one of the responses we gave is not possible given the witness testimony. So
that one was
really interesting case.
That was a refueler story where they had this, the tanker that was supposed to be flying a refueler above. They were saying that, you know, that was one of the debunking or the attempt to debunking it. Yeah, it's one of the great, I think it's one of the great stories, one of the solid stories out there that, that you do here. I certainly think it's in the top, you know, 50 stories anyway.
Agreed. It's a really good case. And so it's an interesting story. And if people are not aware of this case, they should check it out because it's a really interesting case.
I went on the website months ago to see when this UFO festival was this year, and I totally got the date wrong. I missed it. So I really wanted to go. But there's also one going on in New England in October 16th, it is. Pretty sure, and I'm going to be out that way to see my good friend Mark D'Antonio. He'll be there.
Hey, Mark. We're talking about him.
Yeah.
A minute ago. There.
So glad he's doing well.
Yeah,
and
no
we got
kidding.
One more story about
One more story. You had mentioned earlier about Hell and Brimstone coming this month, and we're all going to die or something like this.
Right.
And this story is some evidence to back up your crazy claims. This is
Wait a minute. They're not my claims, just to get that clear. Yeah.
Okay. but this is a giant fireball that was videotaped over Thailand. So a lot of people caught it on video from Bangkok and the surrounding area. And, it's a really cool video of this giant fireball in the sky. Pretty cool. In fact, one of the towns northeast of Bangkok got so freaked out that they thought it was a plane crashing, and they dispatched over 100 rescue workers to go find out what was going on. I don't know what these guys were doing because there was nothing found on the ground. I guess they were looking for something. But the news came that there was no report of a crashed plane, and it was believed to be a meteorite. And so the search was called off. But it's kind of interesting. The Bangkok Post posted a compilation video of some of the videos that people had gotten. And it's like everybody, I don't know what it is, all the mopeds have cameras on them because most of, like, 5 out of these 6 videos are people on mopeds.
Wow.
Which is just kind of funny. I don't know what's going on. I think that's a pretty anomalous phenomena on its own. But, it's a very interesting video. What's funny, too, is people have been giving me a little bit of heck because I said a mysterious fireball caught on video. And they're like, it's not mysterious. It's a meteorite. But actually, there is some mystery because nobody can agree what it is. The local Bangkok astronomer was contacted, the planetarium there, and they said they didn't think it was a meteorite because they didn't have any reports of it. They didn't have any records of one happening. And they suggested maybe it's a burning balloon, interesting enough.
Weird.
However, Phil Platt, a former NASA Hubble Space Telescope guy. You read him a lot. He does a lot. He's a skeptic, really. So he writes about UFOs not in a positive manner often. But he said it's definitely a meteorite because it happened so quickly. However, the Bangkok Post looked up on this website, SatView, anything that could have been re-entering, and they found that it was likely space junk. That at that time, there was supposed to be a rocket falling back into the atmosphere. So they say it's most likely space junk. But So those people who are giving me heck and tell me, oh, it's obviously a meteorite. I don't know. I think if you look here, and I put a link to it because the Bangkok Post put a link, you can clearly see that at that time there was some space junk supposed to be re-entering the atmosphere. So most likely it was space junk or a meteorite and probably not a balloon on fire. But it's very shocking video, so it's really cool.
Right, yeah. And all that can be seen in our show notes, all links that will go back to openminds.tv. Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like you're going to have the next couple of weeks off. Well, I have the next couple of weeks off.
Yeah. Well, that's I'm going to miss talking to you. And if the world should end before your return, and this is the last show, I just want to say that it's been fun. And hey, I've had a great, it's been a great run, I think.
I'm getting teary-eyed here now.
For the show and humanity.
Yeah, same here. Now, I might actually be on your show while I'm in Russia. That's possible because the timing can work better. I'm not going to be on my own show in the middle of the night, but it's possible I can record with you. And it'll be a lot of fun.
That will be awesome. So I'm looking forward to that. I really hope we can make that work.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Alejandro, and we'll be talking to you soon.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
All right. Hang in, everyone, for the quick music break. We'll be right back with Mark O'Connell. Get my last message. How are you, Mark?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. Good. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes. So who is Mark O'Connell? I know Kurt, a mutual friend, former guest on the show, was telling me you'd be a great guest, and you have quite a background. And I want to talk about that, about your Star Trek episodes that you've written, and about all that, your website, highstrangenessufos.com. But first of all, who is Mark, and how did you get interested in the subject to begin with?
Well, Mark is a writer who lives in southern Wisconsin, and I have been interested in science fiction as far back as I can remember. One of my very first memories was of the early 1960s. I was born in 1960, and there was a very famous science fiction TV show on the air in 1962 through, I think, 64, called The Outer Limits. And I can remember very vividly, for some strange reason that I still don't understand, my mom liked to watch that show. And here's little, you know, 2 or 3 year old me. I was terrified of the monsters. They had some really scary monsters on that show. But I was fascinated, and I guess that's kind of what hooked me. And I can then remember a few years later when the original Star Trek went on the air, I was just in heaven because here was this fantastic new science fiction show. But there was one problem. I had a very strict bedtime, and Star Trek went on the air a half hour before my bedtime, but it was an hour-long show. So I can remember begging my mom, pleading with her to just let me stay up a half an hour longer on Thursday night so I could watch the whole Star Trek episode. And then, it's kind of a funny theme, then I can remember when I was about 10 years old, there was a British TV show called UFO that in Milwaukee was aired Saturday nights at 6 p.m. Well, our family had dinner Saturday night at exactly 6:30 p.m. every Saturday. And again, it was an hour-long show. So every Saturday, I started watching UFO, and I had to miss the second half. It wasn't until I was, you know, much later and got to get the shows on UFO on DVD that I was able to actually watch the second halves of all the episodes of UFO.
I just pulled that UFO show up, and I do remember it myself.
It's a fun show. It's a fun show. So I have a long history, and then and the other part of it was that my mom was also – it's funny how my mom is such a big player in this story. She was a volunteer librarian in the small town where I grew up, Big Bend, Wisconsin, and she would take me into the library with her sometimes, and I would – for some reason, I just always gravitated toward the science fiction section. It was a very small library. They couldn't have more than about 20 science fiction books, but I probably read them all. And yeah, like I say, I was just hooked. I've been a lifelong fan ever since.
And so did you just pursue a writing career, basically?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be involved in filmmaking or TV in some way. Spent some time in California, kind of learned a few hard lessons that way. Ended up signing with an agent when Star Trek The Next Generation came on in the late 1980s. I think 87 is when it premiered. I got a script that got noticed at Star Trek The Next Generation, and that led to me. They invited me to pitch story ideas, which I did from Wisconsin. A lot of people flew out to L.A. I couldn't really afford that. I had a couple of young kids, and I couldn't really be flying off to California every couple of months to pitch stories, not knowing if I would actually sell one or not. And in the end, it took me probably half a dozen tries before I finally hit them on the right day with the right idea. And made my first sale, and then made four more sales to them over the next few years.
Wow! And one of them ended up being, I mentioned earlier, it was one of the top shows, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was kind of a kick. Last year, a Hugo Award-winning science fiction author, Charlie Jane Anders, who writes for the website io9.com, she put together a really fun list of what she considered the top 100 Star Trek episodes. So she included all 700 some episodes of the original series, the animated series from the early 1970s, and then of course Deep Space Nine and Next Generation and Voyager and Enterprise. And of that 100, one of my episodes was number 72. It was called Who Mourns for Mourn, and it was a huge kick. I was very honored to make it on that list, because there were a lot of great episodes on that list.
We have a mutual friend, Kurt Collins, who's been on this show, maybe three times or so. He's a serious researcher, and he wouldn't have recommended you for the show unless you were a serious person. So I want to talk about that. What is your involvement with have you done some researching yourself with MUFON or something like that?
Yeah, and I would like to just thank Kurt for recommending me to you. Kurt's been a regular reader of my blog, and I always enjoy his comments and his insights. He's a very interesting guy.
He is.
And I'm glad to be online acquaintances with him. As a writer, I'm always looking for interesting new things to write about. And in 2011, I was in one of those phases where I had nothing to work on, and I wanted to come up with something fun to occupy me. I have a good friend who has been editing a photo blog for many years and is very successful at it. And for years and years, he was bugging me to start writing a blog. He just said, you'd be terrific at it. You'd love it. Well, I could never think of anything that I really was interested in enough that I would want to continue writing about, several times a week for weeks and months and years. I just remembered, oh God, yeah, UFOs, of course. I've always been interested in that. I had kind of lost touch with the field over the years. I hadn't really followed all the things that have been going on over the last probably 15, 20 years. But, once I thought of writing a blog about UFOs, the rest just kind of came naturally. I quickly realized that there are a lot of very smart UFO bloggers and writers out there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really feel like I could compete with them, so I decided that I would make my blog, High Strangeness, a little bit funny when the opportunity arose, and to sort of portray myself as, you know, a little bit of a bumbler in the UFO field. So that's, you know, some of that is a bit of a shtick, although, but there's a lot of me that's really comes through as well. But then when I started writing the blog, I realized, wow, I need a lot of stuff to write about. And I just happened to be on MUFON's website one day, and I saw the button on their website that said, become a certified UFO field investigator. And that's when lightning struck. I thought, of course, I'll become a MUFON investigator, and I can write about that experience in the blog. And that'll be a fun writing project, and hopefully it'll be of interest to some people. So that was the genesis of the whole thing 4 years ago. And so I became a MUFON investigator. I've been doing that for a little over 3 years now, and that's just been a continually fascinating experience on so many levels. I mean, it's fascinating just to hear these firsthand accounts of people who've seen some really, really unusual things, but it's also fascinating just to learn about the kind of people who report these experiences. You know, the psychology behind it is really fascinating to me as well. So that's kind of where I come in. I've been an investigator for MUFON for a little over 3 years. I am now I'm the assistant state director and the chief investigator for the state of Wisconsin. We just brought on two new investigators, which is a huge, huge relief. That's been great because we were a little shorthanded for the last year or so. But our state director, Mike Lucas, does a fantastic job. And it's a lot of fun, like I said before, it's just really fascinating work.
Wow. Okay. If you're listening live, you can jump in our chat room. That's at podcastufo.com and pose a question. You can also call in anytime during the show, and that number is 603-967-4030. Just to let you know, Mark, we don't get a lot of call-ins. Maybe once a show, someone might call in, so don't be waiting for the phone to ring.
Okay.
But you'll see it come up since you're in Skype. You will see it come up, and I will take the call if one does come in.
Okay, great.
And so getting back to your interest in the UFO topic, have you actually seen a UFO? Have you had a sighting yourself?
When I started writing the blog in the summer of 2011, I had a couple sightings that I now think – well, I'm pretty sure one of them was a Chinese lantern. The other one I'm not so sure about because it was stationary in the sky for as long as we watched it, and my wife and daughter saw it at the same time. But we were in a moving car, and we were on a busy highway, so we didn't have a chance to pull over and actually observe it. So I don't have a whole lot of evidence to go on. That one could have been a Chinese lantern, too. But it's still a bit of an unknown for me. But that's all I've seen. I'd love to see more, but it so far.
Those Chinese lanterns piss me off.
They are pesky little buggers, aren't they?
They are. Yeah, that and drones. And so, what is the sightings like in Wisconsin?
It's been kind of up and down. This past year, I have had a whole string of really puzzling historical cases. I've had a whole lot of people who have decided for whatever reason that something they saw 20 years ago or 30 years ago was just really, really rattling around in their head for too long, and they needed to finally tell somebody about it.
I have a theory on that.
Oh, what is it?
And it's come up on a show before, and that is a lot of people are watching this Hangar One. And, you know, I'm not going to critique the show too much. They let a lot of things go that I don't think they should let go as being real. But still, I think that any show like that causes awareness, and people are all around the country, MUFON investigators are talking about old cases are coming to light because people are watching that and they're deciding to contact MUFON because it's so publicized in that show. So that's why the old sightings are coming forth.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience, Martin. I've heard that from a lot of people who they say, yeah, I was watching, and sometimes it's Hangar One, sometimes it's one of the other shows, but they say, yeah, I saw this show on TV, and they showed something that looked a whole lot like what I saw, and I suddenly realized, hey, maybe other people have seen the same thing, and that becomes a big driver for a lot of these people. It's, has anybody else seen the same thing I saw? So yeah, it's an interesting chain reaction that kind of leads people to report their cases. So yeah, the last year or so, lots and lots of historic cases. The summer before that, the summer of 2014, we actually had a little flap right here in South Central Wisconsin, right in my home county, Jefferson County. I had, within the space of 2 months, I had, I think, four or five sightings that were very, very similar. They weren't all on the same night, so it wasn't people seeing the exact same thing, but I had several reports spread over this time period that were remarkably similar, reported by people who I am assuming didn't know each other. And in most of the cases, there were multiple witnesses. Most, three out of the four cases involved families where the husband and wife and at least one of their kids saw what was in the sky. The fourth case was a married couple. But the family cases I thought were really interesting because the dynamic kind of carried out the same way. It was like the dad saw it first, called the kid out, called mom out, and everybody saw it. And in one case in particular, the dad and the son hopped in their car to chase this thing down. And because their first thought was it looked like people over on the next block were shooting laser pointers up in the trees. So they thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Let's go see what's happening. So they got in their car and drove around the block. Well, they couldn't see anything going on with their neighbors, but they could still see this thing in the sky, only now it seemed even further away. So they, over the course of about 45 minutes, they drove to three different spots here in town, in our town, Fort Atkinson, and then drove out of town and kept seeing this thing. And what they saw was a white glowing sphere that towards the end seemed to be sort of wrapped in a cloud-like substance, but there were also some signs of blue and orange lights around the sphere. And they watched it out on this lonely highway outside of town for about 15 minutes, and then it seemed to start moving towards them, and they got very scared and hightailed it home, and they never saw it again. So that was a real baffler, to have all those cases right here within like 10 miles of where I live, all taking place in May and June of 2014, and all involving really kind of similar, I guess we could call them, you know, Hynek's definition of the meandering nocturnal lights. They were all, the objects that were described were all very similar. And then it abruptly stopped. You know, we got to the end of June, there were no more reports. Nobody ever saw anything like that again in our area, or at least nobody reported it.
Wow. Wow, good stuff. Historically, has there been any major case that happened in Wisconsin that comes to mind?
Yeah, one just came up this summer that is still being investigated. I have to apologize. I had a lot of life stuff going on in the last month, so I've basically taken the last month off from blogging and MUFON work. So I'm a little rusty. You'll have to just forgive me.
That's all right.
But earlier this summer, a gentleman reported a case that took place at a military base in central Wisconsin called Fort McCoy. It took place in 1980. This gentleman was retired and living in, I can't remember, somewhere down in the southeast. We had a really fascinating talk. He was very, came off as very sincere on the phone. What had happened was he had been stationed at Fort McCoy in 1980 when the fort was used. This was not a combat fort. It was a training base. And it was being used to house all these Cuban refugees who had come over on the flotilla in 1980 when Castro basically opened up the prisons and let all the bad eggs loose, and they all came over to the U.S. Well, you know, a couple thousand of them ended up in Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, and this gentleman was part of the battalion that had been brought in just to help patrol the base. And at one point, some of the refugees actually tore down a fence and tried to escape. So this gentleman had to be part of a living wall. They made a living fence to cover this part of the fence that had been torn down. And one night, he's out with 50 other guys forming this human chain. And it's his turn to go to sleep. And just as he's getting into his sleeping bag, he sees this object appear from behind the trees. It's roughly rectangular in shape, and it has, he called it a window, but then he said it wasn't really a window because he could tell it didn't have glass in it. It was more of a force shield covering this opening, but he could see two beings inside this window, and as this object moved across the sky from right to left, it seemed to him that the heads of these beings were turning as though they were watching him as the craft went by. And then it disappeared behind the trees. And this guy's lieutenant was standing right next to him when he saw this. And he looked at his lieutenant, and his lieutenant just said, "Don't say a word."
Wow.
And he went to bed. He got into his sleeping bag and went to bed. And he said, "Mark, that was one of the strangest things about this whole story." He said, after this bizarre thing I had just seen in the sky, I put my head on the pillow and I fell into the deepest sleep I've ever had. He said, I should have been wide awake and terrified. He said, I still can't understand why I was able to fall asleep and sleep so soundly. So, and there are a lot of interesting details to this. He said that while he was watching it, he looked up and down the line of his fellow infantrymen who were forming this human wall. And he said they were all staring up at it, and a lot of guys had cameras on them, and they were taking pictures with their cameras. And then the next day, when he got up the next day, he asked his lieutenant. He said, "Well, should we tell the colonel about this?" And the lieutenant said, "You are on your own. I don't want to know what you're going to do." So they saw the commander of the base at breakfast. And this guy, he went up and talked to the commander of the base, and he said, "You know, I saw something very strange, you know, out on the perimeter last night, and I believe a lot of the other guys did too." And the commander of the base said, "I tell you what," he said, "if any of the local papers report on it, then we will file an official report." And the guy who reported the case, he said, "Well, of course the CO knew that as long as we were doing this human fence duty, none of us was ever going to see a local paper. We were never, you know, we had no chance to get off the base and buy a local paper." So he said that was the CO's way of, you know, kind of cleverly just brushing it under the rug. So, but what this guy did next was really interesting. He said, "I still have the duty roster." Because he was the lieutenant's, he was direct, I don't know the ranks, I apologize to if there are military folks out there. He was the aide to the lieutenant who was supervising the human wall. So he sort of had the records and things, and he told me, "I still have the duty roster from that night." And he said, "I always wonder if any of these guys could be contacted, if they would remember anything." So he sent me a copy of the duty roster. We have the duty roster, and I've been talking with my colleagues here at Wisconsin MUFON about, first of all, whether we can do anything with that information, and if we can, then what is the best approach? Because, you know, we would be contacting people about something that happened over, you know, 35 years ago, and they may not want to talk about it. They may not be happy that somebody, you know, had their name and called them. So we've been a little stymied on that. It would be a really big deal if we could get some corroboration on it, but it presents some ethical problems that we haven't really quite been able to solve. But it's been a really fascinating case, and the gentleman has, as he's remembered more details, he's been really great about sending more information about the experience. So his description is very detailed, in my eyes, very, very credible. He really impressed me with his sincerity. He's been sitting on this story for 35 years. He's never told a soul, you know, outside of his commanders. And he has absolutely nothing to gain by reporting the story now. he just saw something on TV that reminded him of it, and he thought, oh, well, I wonder if anybody else has seen anything like this. So,
wow.
Well, that's probably the best one of this latest batch.
Yeah, it actually gave someone on the chat room goosebumps, they said.
Oh, yeah, I felt the same way, believe me.
Yeah. Well, you know, you very, very rarely hear about anyone seeing actual beings. There's probably only a handful of stories that I've heard about. And, you know, one of them, I don't know if you've ever seen the video of the Turkey UFO over the sea, that one. That one shows what looks like it could be beings, and they moving and everything. pardon me.
Well, another thing, if I could just elaborate more on this gentleman's story that he told me. One of the things that I talked before about the psychology of understanding, you know, why people report things. Another aspect of that is, I'm really interested to hear how people express themselves and how they describe things. And so there were certain things in this gentleman's story that he was trying so hard to describe to me, but he just couldn't come up with the word. Even after 35 years, he still couldn't come up with the right words to describe what he saw and what he felt. For instance, the window in the side of the craft that he said wasn't really a window because he could tell there wasn't glass in it. He was really struggling to come up with an explanation for the force field or whatever it was that he thought was in that hole. The other thing was that as this object moved past, there was sort of what looked like sort of a rocket exhaust coming out of the end of it, but it wasn't really moving. It was just sort of static. And he tried so hard to describe this flame, this static flame to me. And after about a minute and a half, he just gave up. He just said, I just don't really know what else to tell you about it. I'm not getting it across. I can't really explain exactly what I saw. And I just can't come up with the right words. So, you know, in that case, he just gave up. He could not figure out how to convey, you know, what he had seen.
Question on the message board. Mm-hmm. Someone wants to know, did he get into details when describing the beings?
All he saw were silhouettes. In fact, when he sent me the duty rosters, he also sent me a sketch that he had made. Huh. And I do have, a scan of that. Again, I apologize. I'm coming into this a little rusty. I don't have visual aids ready, but you know, maybe there's a way we can post this on your website or something.
Sure.
Actually, I think I may have posted this on my blog, but I can't remember.
What I can do is if there's something like this comes up in conversation, if you send me that scan, I'll just put it right in the show notes for the listener.
Okay, great. Well, so he drew a very detailed sketch of the object, and he drew the figures in silhouette, and they look humanoid. It's sort of like the upper half of their bodies, maybe from about, if I remember right, from about waist up maybe, and you can see sort of the shapes of the shoulders and the shapes of heads. So he didn't see any features, he didn't see any skin or clothing or anything. He just saw the silhouettes. But he did sense that the heads were moving in time with the motion of the craft so that they remained looking at him. But I also, when he described that to me, I thought, well, gosh, there were 50 other people seeing the same thing. I wonder if it looked that way to all the other men, because, you know, all these men are basically in a straight line that's running parallel to the trajectory of this object in the sky. So, you know, if we were ever able to get in touch with any of these other folks who were there that night, it would be interesting to see or to hear how they perceived these beings inside the craft.
I was looking through your blog a little bit, and I saw that you wrote on the what I call the Atacama Dr. Greer's baby.
Yeah, I wrote
and,
a lot of that.
I actually did a spoof on that. When he was right before that movie came out, it's on YouTube.
Good, it needs to be spoofed.
So let's touch on that a little bit. And not only that, I did promise the listener that I would not keep bringing up the May 5th mummy But in your opinion, what do you think? I actually think the mummy was worse for the UFO community, but I don't think it got a lot of publicity. The movie Sirius there is all over Netflix and everything else, so it's still, you know, like ongoing. Whereas the mummy is kind of quiet right now, but there are still people clinging on to saying that this is what it's still the alien.
Well, you know, supposedly there was going to be that film Kodachrome that was going to come out anytime now, telling that whole story. I haven't seen a hide nor hair of that, and I kind of doubt that we will. Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I remember now that I included that on one of my haha funny questions that I posted on my blog, Atacama Humanoid or Roswell Slide Being. I think you know, because there was a film associated with the Atacama Humanoid, because it was so closely associated with the citizen hearing on Disclosure, you know, that was all sort of a big package deal that Greer, you know, put together. I think probably at the time, yeah, I think that probably made more waves than the mummy and the Roswell slide. I think the Roswell slide figure was maybe a little more insulated in UFO world. But now, since you bring it up, though, it kind of makes me it makes me think about how early in 2015 there was a whole string in January and February. There was a whole string of news stories about UFOs that really hit the big time. I mean, they were getting big time coverage on the Today Show and CNN. There was, first of all, there was the CIA tweeted that, you know, the vast majority of UFO sightings in the U.S. in the 50s and 60s were because of their U-2 spy planes.
Oh, yes. Right.
You know, that story got a lot of play. It was a bizarre thing for the CIA to be talking about. I still can't figure out why they sent out that blog, but whatever. It got a lot of attention. And then close on the heels of that was that episode where the live video feed from the International Space Station was cut off, supposedly moments after a UFO appeared on screen.
Mm-hmm.
That story got a whole lot of coverage. And it was kind of funny to see. It seemed as though the news outlets that missed out on the first story all just pounced on the next one because they didn't want to lose out. And then after that, there was that story with the blackvault.com where the gentleman who runs that website, you know, got all that attention for saying, hey, I've just released all 130,000 pages of Project Blue Book files for free, when in fact they'd all been available for free for a long, long time already. And that story got immense amount of publicity. So a couple months later, you know, the event in Mexico City with the Roswell slides, I have to wonder, you know, were members of the mainstream media feeling like they had been burned on those first three stories and they just didn't want to touch it? I don't know. Maybe because it took place in Mexico, people just kind of ignored it. I'm not sure.
I think that's the consensus of a lot of people, is because it was in Mexico. And I am actually very thankful for that, because, you know, I just think that was very damaging, or it could have been a lot worse. You know, if it got a great amount of coverage, it would be a real problem, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't spoken to Don Schmidt at all since that happened, but from what I understand, and this may be totally wrong, I don't know, but I think he's still standing with the fact that he thinks that it's an alien.
Well, since you bring up Mr. Schmidt, your listeners will be the first to learn that as of today, I have been challenged by Don Schmidt to have a public debate on Roswell.
Really?
Yes. It's kind of interesting. It's just at the beginning of June, I took part in the first ever Milwaukee Paranormal Conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I had a great time. The organizer, T. Carulos, is a writer who put on this whole conference basically to celebrate the publishing of his book, which, if I remember right, it's over in the next room. I think it's called Monster Hunters, where he basically did some investigative reporting where he spent time out in the trenches with UFO investigators and Bigfoot investigators and I think ghost hunters, and wrote a book about his adventures. So, and he's a Wisconsin writer, so he put together this conference, and true to his book, he had people from all, you know, he had cryptozoologists, he had Loch Ness Monster people, Bigfoot people, zombie people. It was a really entertaining, day, and with a lot of really fun people involved, and it had a little bit, you know, it had a little bit of something for everyone. But I gave one of the talks in the UFO series, and then Don Schmidt gave a talk. He was kind of the keynote address at the end of the evening, and this was just about a month after the Mexico City fiasco. So Schmidt's talk was kind of, he didn't make any outlandish claims, but he, you know, he just kind of sounded very defensive and kind of angry about everything that had happened. And, probably has good reason to feel that way. So the organizer of this event, he's already talked with me about appearing at next year's event, which I will love to do. But he just emailed me this afternoon and he said, "Hey, Mark, I was talking with, you know, one of the people who had helped me to put together the first conference. We were talking about ideas for next year's conference, and we thought it would be fun if we could get you and Don Schmidt to agree to have a debate on stage." And he said, all of a sudden today, out of the blue, I get an email from Don Schmidt saying, "Hey, I'll appear at your next conference if I can have a debate on stage with Mark O'Connell." Huh. So I'm feeling very flattered. I've just risen up in the ranks. Now I'm going to be on stage with Don Schmidt. So I wrote back to T and I said, "Yes, I am very interested." I didn't give him a complete yes, I will do it, because I'd need to know more about, you know, what the parameters of the debate will be and how it will be held. But, you know, assuming we can work out all the details and everyone's in agreement on how it'll happen, I think it would be a really fun and interesting event.
Now, so what is your take on Roswell in general? Besides, let's just put the alien slide thing away for right now.
Gladly.
Yeah.
My take on Roswell is that it's a very entertaining story, and it's possible that something very amazing happened, but nobody has ever been able to prove anything, and pretty much the ticking clock has run out, I think. At the same time, if I would be hard pressed to prove that nothing happened in Roswell, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think Don Schmidt can prove that anything did happen, and I don't think I would be able to prove that anything didn't happen. So if that was the debate, it would be kind of boring, and I think it would be a stalemate. Uh-huh. If it was a debate about who knows more about Roswell, Don Schmidt would win hands down. I mean, that's all the guy does. He knows all the names and dates and places and, you know, in incredible detail. I do not. You know, I'm not a student of that case, not any more than I need to be. So if the debate was either one of those two formats, I would have some problems with it. So I think if we can come up with some aspect of Roswell where, you know, there it's clearly defined that you can either be pro or con, you know, I think we can work something out. But I'm giving you a much longer answer than you asked for. No. I think it's a really fun story. It's a really entertaining story, but I don't know that it's anything more than that because, again, nobody's proven anything. There have been all these smoking guns over the years that have turned out to be nothing. I just don't. To me, there are a lot more interesting cases. You know, there's the Warren, Minnesota case. I think I'm getting that right, with the sheriff's deputy whose squad car was essentially attacked by a UFO.
Oh yeah,
and that police car is sitting in a museum in northern Minnesota,
right,
with its dented hood and cracked windshield and burned out lights. That's physical evidence right there. Why isn't anybody paying any attention to that? See, for my money, that's a case that should be investigated, and yet it just sits there getting completely ignored. I don't know. It's a funny business. It's hard to explain things like that.
Yeah. Well, we're at the top of the hour, and generally speaking, we take a break here, but I'm going to keep going, and this show. Generally, it's second hour by subscription, but this show is going to be free, so to everyone. So we're just going to move on. We're on the line with Mark O'Connell. And if you want to call in, it's 603-967-4030. Or if you want to ask a question, you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com.
Hey, Martin, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I don't mean to derail the conversation because I love everything we've been talking about. But there's something that I want to ask this in my blog. Actually, I have kind of already asked it in my blog, but I'd love to ask it of your listeners, too. My dad, who turns 90 in November and has been on six continents, has always wanted to get to the seventh continent, Antarctica. And a couple of weeks ago, he surprised our entire family by announcing that he is taking me and four of my siblings to Antarctica this December. And it's going to be an amazing trip, and I'm going to see things in the sky that I've never seen before and probably never will again. And I would love to know if there are any I mean, of course, we all know about Hitler's secret UFO base under the ice in Antarctica. Of course. Be looking for that.
Yeah.
But I want to know if there are any other stories involving, I mean, we'll be in Buenos Aires. We will be in Tierra del Fuego. If anybody knows of stories attached to those places and to Antarctica, I would love to hear them because I'd love to know more about what kinds of things are seen in that part of the world.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's really something. Your father at 90 years old, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Good for him.
He's quite a guy, yeah.
He must be. He must be. Well, moving on about Roswell, the one thing that in that case in particular that I don't think it's a case that's going to die away at any time soon anyway. And, you know, a lot of times myth does become reality. There's a lot of times where you'll see, like, a UFO show and it'll talk about something that you know was a myth and that they make it seem like it really did happen, that type of thing. But the one thing that always puzzles me about Roswell the most is, why on earth would the Army Air Force say they captured a disc? I just can't understand any way that they could get that wrong before they publicized it. And so that alone makes that case, I think, really important and something.
I agree. There are a lot of really fascinating questions around it. Some of the questions I have are, I like to look at the totality of the UFO phenomenon and experience and look at what are some of the other things that UFO witnesses have experienced. People have experienced missing time. People have experienced apparitions that seem to appear from other dimensions that sort of appear and disappear at will in our dimensions. And if we consider all of those things as things that could apply to any UFO sighting anywhere, then I always have to look at Roswell in terms of, well, even if they're dumb enough to fly halfway across the universe or transfer from another dimension and still not be able to nail the landing, even if they're that dumb, which I have a hard time believing, why wouldn't they have a cleanup crew show up immediately and sweep up the debris so that Mac Brazel didn't have anything to find? That, to me, is just defies all belief. Why would there be any wreckage there at all? Or why wouldn't they manipulate time so that the crash never happened? I mean, if you really want to start applying things that people have reported in other UFO cases, then suddenly you've got a million different ways for how that Roswell story could have gone, and you have to ask, why didn't it go any of those ways? Why instead are we supposed to believe that it actually unfolded in this really kind of pedestrian way dictated by our laws of logic and reality when every other case kind of you know, plays out in a completely different way? That's kind of the big issue I have with Roswell.
I understand part of that, a good part of that. And, well, one thing I have to say about the crashing part of it and is that no matter where, like to say if we were traveling space, if we ever can get that advance without blowing everyone up, and we're traveling space, well, if we come into a relatively primitive society, a primitive technology. Perhaps, you know, people have speculated maybe they weren't ready for radar bouncing off of their electromagnetic propulsion or whatever it was that could have possibly made them crash. Maybe there are things, radio waves or just something that they wouldn't expect and have a natural defense against or something like that. I mean, the whole thing is the more you look into it, the more of a mystery it all becomes. And it's all speculation. And that's kind of why I like doing this show. It's a lot of ideas and speculation, getting to hear from other people like yourself and what their ideas are on the whole thing. So
Go ahead. I was just going to say I have a tagline on my blog that says, ambiguity is more convincing than certainty. And I really, when it comes to UFOs, I really truly believe that. Ambiguity makes it more believable to me. I don't really know how to explain that because it's counterintuitive. But it sounds as though you kind of feel the same way on a certain level.
Have you ever looked, the one thing that someone just brought it up on the message board that is interesting is also the memo that is being held in, I'm trying to remember who was holding it in their hand when they were handling the debris. Jesse Marcel was holding a memo, yeah, that was, they've been trying to clear up, you know, through filters and through technology, trying to clear up what the memo is actually saying. Have you looked into that at all? That's interesting.
I've only looked into it a little bit, and only insofar as I thought it was a bit strange that the same people who were saying that enhancing the placard in the Roswell slides was kind of a dirty trick and couldn't be trusted, those very same people seem to be turning around and saying, yeah, that memo held by, held by, was it the Ramey memo? That's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These are the same people who are saying, well, we've digitally enhanced that memo and we can read exactly what it says. No, you can't have it both ways. If you can digitally enhance one to see what it really says, then you can digitally enhance the other. And likewise, if you can't digitally enhance one, then you probably can't digitally enhance the other. So my only contact with the Ramey memo just comes from that kind of that annoyance with me that, of course, I wrote about in my blog. I just thought, and the words that apparently can be read on the Ramey memo don't really mean a whole lot, as I recall. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in it.
It seems like they should be able to even enhance it as we go along. You know, wait, everything always gets better and better. Maybe eventually they'll be able to get the full text out of that.
I wanted to mention something that you were just talking about, though, about how these storylines get reinforced in popular culture. I've been thinking a lot about that lately because my wife and I have been watching The X-Files all the way through. We're at the beginning of season three. Now, neither one of us ever watched it in the 90s. I don't even know why. I don't have an excuse. I was a sci-fi fiend. I have no idea why I didn't watch that show, but I didn't. So now we're watching it, and, you know, starting a season three, we're really starting to get into the whole alien, the whole disclosure conspiracy storyline. And it's silly in a lot of ways, but it's also a lot of fun. It's good entertainment. But I've really been enjoying the way the writers of the X-Files kind of used those storylines, like the Roswell narrative, kind of used them to their own ends to create their own mythology, but at the same time kind of validated the mythology surrounding the original story. You know, when Mulder says something about Roswell in an episode of The X-Files, you know, 25 or 30 million people are watching that. Mm-hmm. And how many of those people are saying, aha, Mulder believes it. It must be true. And, you know, and so you got this sort of circular reinforcement of the mythology while creating new mythology. It's if I was a social scientist, I would be digging into this like crazy. I think it's really fascinating. And there's a really funny line in one of the season one episodes with Deep Throat and Mulder. They're talking about something to do with an alien crash. And Mulder says, oh, Roswell. and Deep Throat just kind of gives him this really kind of dismissive look. And he says, he's like, oh, forget Roswell. Roswell's smoking mirrors. He goes, we have many, many better crash sites than Roswell. That line just cracked me up. Huh. Because, there's probably an element of truth in that, even though it was just written as a line in a TV show.
Right, right. Let's talk about Disclosure. What do you think about Disclosure?
I've said this before in my blog. It seems to me that if Disclosure was really a thing, then it's up to the aliens to decide. The aliens can show themselves to us anytime they want. They're not going to wait for a decision by any earthly government. That just makes no sense to me. And I went to a talk by Richard Dolan a couple of years ago at a MUFON meeting, and I asked him that. I just said, isn't it up to the aliens? And he just looked at me and he said, well, they haven't done it yet, have they? So apparently it's not. And I thought, well, that's not very sound logic. Just because they haven't yet doesn't mean they can't. It just means they haven't yet. So, no, I'm not a big fan of Disclosure. I think it's like I said, the aliens, assuming the aliens exist, they hold all the cards here. Why would it be up to world governments, who are essentially powerless against them? The aliens can do whatever they want, whenever they want. So, yeah, it's in their hands.
I agree with you on that. I think that if they wanted to show themselves, they could definitely do that. And,
yeah.
You know, and then, but there may be many reasons why they don't. You know, maybe they don't want to interfere with the social growth of our society being left alone, or who knows what. You know, one thing I bring up all the time, who knows what they are anyway? You know,
yeah.
A lot of people are seeing something definitely that can't be explained. Mm-hmm. You know, people throw out numbers like 5% of UFOs are unexplainable or whatever it is, you know, somewhere around there. But the fact of if it was just one, you know, to me means that, you know, we are being visited by something unexplainable.
Mm-hmm.
And we may never even know what it is, and we may have a total wrong idea about what it is.
Yeah, and I agree completely, and I personally am completely comfortable with that. You know, that, and again, it goes back to my little catchphrase of ambiguity is more convincing than certainty. I don't have to know what it is. And some of that belief has been reinforced by the work I've done researching the work of Dr. J. Allen Hynek for the biography I'm writing of him.
Oh, I want to talk about that. But before we do, I just want to I want to get this question out because this gentleman asked a while back. What real-life UFO-based mythology have you used for inspiration in your own writings for TV, et cetera?
Oh, that's a great question. I have an unsold script. I never actually wrote the full script, but wrote a very detailed story treatment. And this was probably about, 10 or 12 years ago, that actually had a lot to do with Area 51 and the idea that the United States government is keeping captured alien spaceships under wraps at Area 51. So, you know, old story. It's been used a million times, and it will be used a million times before. This actually came about because I'd been approached by a comic book company that had they were looking at titles in their comics library to develop as feature films, and one of their comic titles had to do with an alien flying saucer at Area 51, and somebody who actually steals the flying saucer and gets away with it. So I can't even say it was an original story, but that was the comic book that they wanted me to develop. And as I said, I wrote a very, very detailed story treatment. I'm going to guess it was probably close to 20 pages, which for a story that's a lot of work. The comic book company never went ahead with it. And because it was based on their property, it wasn't something that I could go shop around to anyone else. So unfortunately, when they decided not to move ahead with the project, that was the end of it. But having said that, though, there are still little bits and pieces of it that were my original work that I added to their story that, of course, I still have, you know, on file in my file cabinet and kicking around in my brain. And it's always possible that some little bit of that material could still work its way into something. You just never know.
Uh-huh. And, okay, so let's move back into what you were just talking about before I pose that question. You are writing a biography on J. Allen Hynek?
Yeah.
And can you tell us about it and
sure.
What got you started?
I'm always happy to talk about it. It's the biggest writing project I've ever done and the most difficult by far, but also I think the most rewarding. This all goes back to, again, 4 years ago when I started writing my blog, High Strangeness. My wife at the time was working in Chicago, so we spent a lot of time in Chicago, sort of splitting our time between southern Wisconsin and Chicago. So, again, when I was sort of fishing around for material to write about in the blog, I also came across the website for KUFOS, the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. And I was very intrigued to find that the center was literally within 5 miles of our apartment in Chicago. I got very excited about that and contacted their scientific director, Dr. Mark Roediger. And by the time he and I talked, the info on the website was actually obsolete. They had closed down their office and had actually moved what was left of the center's records and resources into a couple members' basements throughout Chicago. So Mark Roediger had a whole lot of the archives in his basement. And he said, well, you know, the offices don't exist anymore, but you'd be more than welcome to come over to my house and, you know, poke around in the basement and, you know, see if anything there catches your interest. So I was thrilled to get that invitation. Had always been interested in Hynek and his work. But had never really, you know, only really knew what I had read in books. And so when I started visiting KUFOS, just looking for material, fun stories to write about in my blog, I got to know Mark a little. And after a couple of visits, he mentioned that they had always been interested in finding a writer to write the definitive account of Dr. Hynek's career. And I just said, well, I would love to do that. I just jumped on it. I said, I would love to be that writer. And he said, well, you know, why don't you give it a try? So I started working right then and there. And Mark read a lot of my initial drafts of chapters and has been happy with the direction the book is going and has also been an incredible resource for me as a fact checker. He clears up things that I don't get quite right. He points me in directions to do, you know, new research on things. So the research has been really fascinating, and it's been helped by the fact that not only are Hynek's KUFOS files in the Chicago area in these people's basements, but Hynek was also the chairman of the astronomy department at Northwestern University from 1960 until his retirement in the early 80s. So there is a wealth of material in the Northwestern University archives. Hynek also went to school. He was born and raised in Chicago and went to school at the University of Chicago. There is a wealth of archival material in the University of Chicago archives. So, and he did his graduate work at Yerkes Observatory in southern Wisconsin, about a half an hour from where I live. So it just turned out that all of these resources dealing with Hynek's career were really at my fingertips, and I just went nuts with the research. So I've been researching and writing for a while. The big news is that just about 3 weeks ago, I signed with a literary agent who is now going to start shopping the book project around to publishers. And we want to pitch this book as not just a UFO book. We want to sell it to a publisher as a book that also is that also can appeal to a mainstream audience. And if you look at the kind of audience that the X-Files brings in and the kind of audiences that shows like Hangar One and Ancient Aliens bring in, it's not too big of a stretch to say that, you know, this isn't just a niche market. This is a topic that is of interest to a whole lot of people. And there is a huge audience. So we think we can be successful in pitching this to, you know, to a big publisher and you know, hopefully making it a big book.
Well, you know, he was such a fascinating man. You know, if you really think about his involvement with Project Blue Book and how he was out there to try to debunk, you know, everything, his swamp gas talk and all that. And then, you know, he comes over to the UFO side, you know, after, which I think is really amazing. And, you know, that he spent the last part of his life just saying, hey, you know, something is going on and, really curious about the subject.
It's a great story. He was a complicated man. I've learned so much since I've done this research because, as I mentioned before, what little I knew of Hynek was just stuff I had read in UFO books. And let's be honest, some of those UFO books are biased. Some of them simply repeat information that's already been, you know, that's already been written in other formats and other media. So, you know, the end result is over time, you know, the same stories get told and retold and repeated and those stories aren't always accurate, but they sort of become sort of the conventional wisdom of who this guy was and what his work represented. So it's been a huge surprise to me and really a huge adventure to find out that his work is, you know, it's a much more complicated story than I would have imagined. You know, there's a lot of gray area. He made a lot of mistakes. He did things he regretted. You know, he should have changed his mind sooner, but he actually did start changing his mind a lot sooner than most people think. So, you know, there's a really good story there, and I think people are going to like it a lot. The title of the book is The Close Encounters Man: How Dr. J. Allen Hynek Made It Okay for America to Believe in UFOs. Because the thrust of the book is that because of his work, we now live in a world. Even though he died in 1986, the man's been gone a very long time, but his work planted a seed that has just bloomed into, you could easily call it a UFO industry, but more than that, it's developed into, you know, a set of cultural beliefs. Everybody knows what a close encounter is, and Hynek thought of that terminology, you know, and Spielberg used it for his movie, and it's part of our cultural, you know, it's a cultural reference point now. So like I say, I think I have a good story to tell and I'm very excited about the book.
Wow. I know someone that knew him personally, someone just mentioned on the message board, Ray Stanford is actually, he does listen to the show quite a bit. We'll probably listen to this show in particular. I don't know if he's listening now or not, but, Ray Stanford is a good resource probably to get some information from.
I would love to talk with him.
Yeah, I can set all that up easily. And so you gave me a couple of fun questions that I could ask you. And I want to know this one. Why are ufologists so grumpy and irritable? I love that one.
And, well, grumpy is too strong a word. Okay. I shouldn't have used the word grumpy. Because what I was really getting at was, and again, this goes back to when I first started the blog 4 years ago, and I started reading other people's blogs, and just found that, like I said, there were an awful lot of very serious UFO scholars who were doing very serious work and very serious writing, and I wanted to try to find a way to stand out from that in my own way. So to me, I just sort of tended to look at these serious writers as, you know, maybe a little grumpy sometimes and maybe a little set in their ways. It's probably unfair. As I say, grumpy is probably too strong a word. But having said that, I do think that there is, it's interesting to me how many ufologists have a hard time looking at the phenomenon with any sort of sense of humor, because it does get pretty strange sometimes. And sometimes it's kind of funny how strange it gets. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of to the point where it just defies belief how strange things get. And I think there are things in this world, there are things in the UFO world that can be pretty funny. And I was very surprised to find that not many people seem to recognize that or appreciate that. So that's kind of what I've set out to illuminate in my work.
I like that. I have brought up a number of times that a lot of times people do get sort of tarnished. You know, I talk to a number of people that have been in the field for a long time. And, you know, a lot of times they just say, you know, I've had it. You know, nothing's going to change. Are you there? I think we may have lost Mark. I'm going to try to get him back. Mark, are you there?
I'm sorry. Something happened. I accidentally cut us off. I'm here.
You're back. Okay. You're going to have to move up to your mic. I can just barely hear you.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's that?
There you are. Okay.
Good.
I forgot what I was babbling about, but...
oh, I'm sorry.
No. A lot of ufologists get sort of burnt out. I guess that might be the phrase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are not seeing anything happen within many years, any changes.
Yeah.
So I can understand that.
Yeah, and I've only been in this for 4 years, and I can already kind of feel some of that myself. It does get very frustrating when you feel as though we as a group, ufologists, people who are interested in the field, have tried so many different approaches to try to get a handle on what this phenomenon is and what it means, and seem to come up short with every attempt. It does definitely lead to a sense of frustration. What have we not thought of? What haven't we tried? And I just don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that.
Right. Same here. One of your other funny questions here was, what is your favorite level at the Dulce Underground Base? And we've talked about that a number of times on this show. You know, basically that it was just disinformation, Paul Benowitz disinformation. But that, you know, going back to the myth that becomes reality, there's a lot of people out there that still think there's an underground base there with aliens.
Well,
tanks.
I first came across this. This happened right when I started writing the blog. So summer and fall of 2011. There's actually a very small but popular UFO conference not far from here. It's called the Burlington Vortex Conference. So it's not just UFOs. There is a vortex in the woods outside of this town of Burlington, Wisconsin. So I went to this, again, looking for material for my blog, and I actually ended up writing an article about it for Milwaukee Magazine. But I met a young couple there who were fascinated with Dulce Base, and I had never heard of it before. And they started telling me about it, and, man, they were dead serious. They were like, they believed every word of it. Oh, my God, yes, the grays live on this level, and the reptoids live on that level, and... You know, and the mantises hate the reptoids, and the reptoids hate the grays, and I was kind of blown away. I was not prepared for that deep level of mythology, and to find that this really is a thing. This is a thing that a lot of people say is true was just kind of a stunner for me. I also had I want to tell this story too because it's kind of along those same lines. Where you really have to wonder what makes people believe certain things and where your own belief system kind of comes up short. I had a really fascinating case from MUFON a couple of years ago. It was a young college student who had been home for summer break, and he was staying at his folks' house, and he was driving home from one night in the late at night around midnight, and he saw this object fly across the highway in front of him. It was glowing blue. It was about the size of a refrigerator. It zoomed across the highway about 3 feet off the ground. And as it flashed past the front of his car, he could have sworn that his dash lights flickered. Okay, so technically that makes it a close encounter of the second kind, right? Because there are physical effects on the environment. So by the time they reported this and I was able to meet with the family, their son had already gone back to, I think it was, I can't remember. It was out of state. He had gone back to college out of state, so I couldn't talk to him. But I had a really fascinating talk with the parents, and they told me the whole story from their point of view about, you know, how their son called them immediately, and they could tell how shaken up he was, and they were sure he wasn't making this up. But as we talked, it turned out that this family has had a whole lot of really strange experiences, some of them centered on the house they live in, a very old house. And they were telling me about how they think they have shadow people living in their house. That was a new one to me. I'd never heard of shadow people. But then at some point in the conversation, the father said, "Hey, there's something I want to show you. I've never shown this to anyone." It was part of their family history, and it was sort of sensitive because it revealed some private life details of some of their relatives that they wanted to keep private. So they never wanted to share this letter with anyone, but he shared it with me and said, you know, please don't like broadcast this everywhere, but I'd like to know what you think of it. And it was a letter from a friend of the family to a family member from 1950 from Pendleton Air Force. I know what was it Pendleton? Okay. I'm blanking on that now, but it was an air base in California. Mm-hmm. And the person writing the letter had been a serviceman in 1950 and told this very long, it was like 10 sheets of paper, this very long story about how he and his platoon had been exposed to a genuine flying saucer. And they had been exposed to all this information about how the flying saucer worked and who piloted it and where it came from. And it was in very explicit detail, very precise wording in this letter. And I was just fascinated by this, and you know, these folks had no idea what it meant. They just said, you know, we've never been able to figure out, is this letter for real? Is it a joke? And I said, well, and they asked me if I had any information, and I said, well, there's somebody I can talk to who I think might be able to shed some light on this if you'll let me. So I talked with, I went back to my main source, Dr. Mark Rodiger at the Center for UFO Studies. And I just started reading him just a couple little passages from this letter just to give sort of a flavor of the detail in this. And he said, hang on a minute. I know what that is. And he went to a bookshelf and he got a book off the shelf and he came back to the phone and he flipped open this book and he started reading back to me word for word everything that was in this letter that these people had. And it turned out the book he was reading from was Frank Scully's 1950 UFO book, in which Scully unleashed the concept of the flying saucer crash and the captive flying saucer and alien corpses. And, you know, that was a very elaborate and detailed hoax. And here somehow these people in Wisconsin had that very same story written in a personal letter from a friend of the family to a member of their family. How do you account for that? Mark and I just had a really interesting conversation trying to figure out, you know, what does all this mean? And we finally decided that it must be some sort of psyops that the military was doing to try to sort of inoculate us against fear of aliens from other worlds by sort of selectively showing different people things that they would believe represented aliens from another world, whether they did or not didn't matter, as long as they believed that it did. And then that story would just sort of spread out through people sending these letters to friends and things, so that when the aliens finally did appear, we would all be sort of prepared for it on a certain level. That theory makes as much sense as anything else. It was one of the strangest experiences I've had as a MUFON investigator. It still makes me scratch my head. I just don't know what to make of it. But again, it goes back to that whole issue of myth-making and how do you know where the myth starts and where, you know, how much of it is the person's actual experience and how much of it has been sort of added on over the years. Who knows?
Wow. I wonder if anyone out there has ever heard about a similar letter written. Or if this was just, you know, one person's idea of hoaxing their family, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Today it's YouTube. you know.
Right, you're exactly right. Well, that was one of the things Mark and I talked about. This, the person who wrote the letter, was that person being hoaxed, or was that person part of the hoax?
Hmm.
You know, I mean, there's so many ways you can go with it, and there's so many different levels to the story. It can kind of drive you nuts.
Did you say this was 1952?
Well, I know Scully. Oh, yeah. The letter was dated 1952. That's correct. Scully's book was published in 1950. So this was two years after the book came out.
And that's when the most sightings were seen in this whole country during that time, 1952.
Yeah, which we now know is because of the CIA and their U-2 spy plane.
Well, there is. I think we did talk about
solved.
That. Yeah. At least according to them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to read another one of one of your questions that I thought was kind of humorous, and that is, should have Kenneth Arnold kept his lips sealed?
Well, yeah, that's something I think about since I've been working on this book, because, you know, as we all know, it all goes back to Kenneth Arnold in his plane flying over the Cascade Mountains, and he saw those nine crescent-shaped things flying through the air in a straight line among the mountain peaks. I don't know. It's a fascinating story, and I think, I guess, to give you a serious answer, I think if it hadn't been him, it would have been somebody else, probably within that same historical time period, because I have a feeling that was just sort of the right time for this phenomenon to present itself to us. I don't know why I say that. I just have kind of a gut feeling that if it hadn't been Kenneth Arnold, it would have been somebody else, because that was the time it had to happen. But, you know, then Kenneth Arnold gets involved in that whole Maury Island thing, where he suddenly becomes, you know, amateur UFO investigator and seems to be dealing with, you know, con men who are several pay scales above him. That story really makes me wonder about Kenneth Arnold. That story makes me wish he had kind of kept his yap shut.
I think I read something or someone sent me something that Maury Island is now considered a hoax. I don't know if I could just be, I'm just saying that. I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, that was quite a story.
Unfortunately, you know, the question of whether the case itself was a hoax, or it started out as something genuine, but then it got sort of turned into a hoax because of some disinformation campaign, you know, you kind of have to look at it. You kind of have to at least consider that possibility as well, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there was a crash also to a pilot, and I think it was Air Force people, wasn't it, that were investigating and had some of the so-called evidence with them in a plane that crashed? I'm not sure if you know about
that. I can't remember if they were Air Force people, but I think they were government people at any rate.
Yeah.
Some agency.
Right. So what do you think, what is your idea of the best UFO case out there?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. There are a couple that I've just really become fascinated with as I've worked on the Hynek book. There are some that I haven't gotten to yet that I'm looking forward to getting to, namely the Coyne helicopter case from 1973. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a really fascinating case because, you know, that the Coyne case basically became Hynek's gold standard for a UFO event. Credible observers, all trained observers, you know, they're all a helicopter crew. Their eyewitness testimony all corroborated each other. It was additionally corroborated by witnesses on the ground who saw what was happening and thought that they were about to witness a midair collision. That's a very, very compelling case, and I'm really looking forward to digging into that. My personal favorite, though, is the Pascagoula abduction case, which took place about 3 weeks before the Coyne helicopter case. And that's my favorite because, again, going back to my childhood, I can still remember that was 1973. I would have been around 13 years old. I can still remember that case made the national news. They reported on it on the radio. They reported on it in the newspaper. They reported it on the TV news. And that was a first for me. I had never been aware, at least, before then of a UFO case hitting the big time as far as the national press goes. And to me, that sort of, it wasn't just something I was reading about in a book anymore. It was something that really happens to real people. And I was just really drawn in by that story, and I've always been a huge fan of that.
Mark, did you contact me a while ago to get a hold of Calvin?
I believe I did, yes.
Ah, okay.
That is correct. Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, Calvin. Calvin's a great guy. I had him on.
He's dying to talk to him.
He rarely does interviews, and I was lucky enough to get him on. He's the sole survivor of that incident. And kind of a really great story. I'll just tell you, I have told it quickly on the show. That show actually connected him to his estranged daughter. And talked to each other every single day.
Wow.
She found his information on my show and contacted me, and I got the two together. It was just one of those great things that makes me really happy that I do this show, that, you know, something like that happened out of it.
Wow, that's really profound. I'm glad you told me that story. That's really kind of given me the chills.
Well, I'll tell you, he's such a nice gentleman. It was a real pleasure talking to him.
Well, you know, researching that story, he and Charlie Hickson both come off as such sincere, genuine people. I was surprised to find out how well documented that case was once I started doing the research.
For the listener out there, why don't you just go over the case?
Oh, sure. These two men were out fishing on a pier in Pascagoula, Missouri, near a shipyard where they worked. It was after dark. I can't remember how late, maybe 10 or 11 at night. And it was an older man, Charlie Hickson, and a younger man, Calvin Parker, who Charlie knew Calvin's parents, and he had sort of promised their parents that he would sort of look after him when he moved to the big city. So these two guys were out fishing on the pier along this little channel behind the shipyard. And the fish aren't biting, and they can't figure out why. And Charlie turns around to get some bait from his tackle box, and he sees this blue glowing object, sort of oval or egg-shaped, kind of dropping down out of the sky. And it comes down and hovers on the ground a short distance behind them. By this time, Calvin has turned around and seen it. And both men stand up to look at it, and it's got this white egg-shaped craft, has two glowing blue lights on the side. And as they watch, a door opens on the side of the object, and these three strange creatures come floating out. They never touch the ground. They don't even really have feet. They just have sort of knobs at the ends of their legs. And they have sort of crab-like pinchers on the ends of their arms. And they have kind of featureless heads, but there's a pointy thing where the nose should be and two pointing things where the ears should be. And there's a tiny little slit where the mouth should be, but there are no eyes, as I remember. And Calvin and Charlie feel paralyzed. Could have just been fear, or it could have been something else. And these creatures kind of take them by the arms and float them into their craft. Calvin passes out as they're being led into the craft. So he doesn't remember anything, at least at the time. Charlie, the older man, stays awake, and he's sort of inspected inside the ship by this sort of mechanical eye that sticks out of the wall.
Right, yeah.
And it examines him from head to toe, and about 20 minutes later, they take him back outside. Calvin's already outside of the craft. He's sort of kneeling down on the gravel, just sort of petrified with fear, or with his hands stretched out. I think I'm getting that detail right. And they deposit Charlie, the older man, next to him, and they go floating back into the craft, and then the craft disappears. The craft doesn't fly back up into the sky. It just kind of pops out of existence, which is an interesting detail that pops up in a lot of UFO experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real tricky thing to explain. I don't know what that means. But at any rate, so these two men have gone through this experience, and they go to the local sheriff, and this is one of the most famous parts of the case. The sheriff is completely bewildered by what these men are telling him. Of course, they split the two men up, and they get stories from each of the men, and their stories match up pretty much identically, aside from the fact that Calvin passed out. And then they leave the two men together in an interrogation room with a hidden tape recorder. And the sheriff is really pleased with how smart he is. He thinks he's going to get to the bottom of this. He thinks as soon as they leave these two guys alone in their room, they're going to start laughing their heads off and slapping each other on the backs, you know, congratulating themselves on what a great joke they pulled on the sheriff. And instead, they get a tape recording of this conversation between these two men who are clearly just terrified out of their wits. And they have no idea how to process what they've just gone through. And they just want to go home and have a stiff drink and get to bed and forget it all. And the sheriff and his deputies are just astounded by this tape recording. It's the exact opposite of what they thought they would hear. And so the two guys go home, and the sheriff promises them that he will not tell anybody about what happened. But the next day, Pascagoula, Missouri, is filled with reporters from all over the country. Somehow the story leaks out from the sheriff's department, and the press picks it up. And Hynek was there to investigate. Hynek was actually working as a consultant to NBC News at the time on a news special that they were preparing on the UFO phenomenon. And so Hynek was flown down to Pascagoula, and he was there when a psychologist attempted to hypnotize the two witnesses. And that attempt failed because they were both so terrified. Every time the hypnotist tried to get these two gentlemen to relive their experience, they would just become completely terrified and they couldn't go on. So they just had to stop the hypnosis. It just didn't work. About a month later, Calvin, by this time, had been institutionalized for the first time as a result of his experience. So Charlie, the older man, undertook a polygraph test, and he passed the polygraph test with flying colors. And the polygraph operator was quoted as saying, "I'm not saying he saw a spaceship, but when he says he saw a spaceship, he's not lying."
Hmm.
It's an incredible story. I'm getting the goosebumps just telling the story.
Yeah. Well, you told it pretty well.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, that, to me, I was thrilled to get a hold of Calvin and have him on the show. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I'd almost like to have someone like him back, but it's basically telling the same story. Mm-hmm. However, I've had Travis Walton on like five times, so maybe you know, that's another interesting case, in my opinion. So those are really good stories. We have about somewhere around 5 minutes or so left. And so let's see. You did make this list of really funny questions, so I'm going to see if I can just ask.
I'm glad you thought they were funny.
Yeah, they're pretty good. Oh, which cable TV UFO show is the best or at least the worst as far as reenactments of UFO cases?
I can't say that I've seen all of the shows, but what I have seen, I've been very impressed with the Canadian show called Close Encounters. Hmm. I can't remember which channel it's on now. I'm a little biased on that because Mark Rodiger is one of their guest experts, so he's in a lot of the episodes, and rightly so. The guy's just he's an encyclopedia of UFO lore. But I've been very impressed with that show, with the way they recreate the UFO sightings. In fact, that show was where I first learned about the Warren, Minnesota, the sheriff's car in Minnesota that got attacked by the UFO, because they did a really nice reenactment of that sighting.
Mm-hmm.
So again, qualifying the answer by saying I haven't seen all the shows. Of the ones I've seen, that one impresses me. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I think it's good when someone sticks to the story and does it well. But when you actually know a story and you see that they're going wrong with it, or you've done some research on a story and then you see that, you know, they're bringing in other aspects to make it more interesting, it's just too bad they feel as though they have to, you know, accentuate a story and change things to make it better.
Well,
a lot of that is done on the cutting room floor, too.
Yes, and I've just had a recent experience with that. I just did my first cable TV guest expert appearance in July on Mysteries at the Monument on the Travel Channel. They did a story on the swamp gas case in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to make the case that case was the exact moment when J. Allen Hynek changed his mind and sort of recanted on UFOs and became a believer. And what that case was certainly part of the process Hynek went through, but it wasn't the exact moment. There wasn't any exact moment, you know, was the point that I was trying to get across. You know, him changing his mind actually took place over about 8 or 10 years. It was a long, painful process for him to decide that he had been wrong. You know, it didn't just happen overnight. It happened over a long period of time. But so I tried to get that point across in my interview. But the producers of the show really wanted to have that one dramatic moment where you're like, you know, Hynek has his epiphany where he realizes he's been wrong and he instantly changes his mind. So that's the storyline they went with. I was a little disappointed. So, you know, they got the spirit of the story right, but they didn't get the details right. But that's what happens with these TV shows.
Right. So we have like a minute and a half left here. So do you want to give out your blog site?
Sure. It's highstrangenessufo.com.
And being a writer, have you thought about writing a book on the topic?
On UFOs? Aside from the Hynek book, you mean?
Right.
Oh, yeah. I think about it all the time. And the blog has given me, between the blog and the work I've done for MUFON, there are a couple different directions I could go with it. And I probably won't decide which direction to go with it until I'm done with the Hynek book, to be honest.
Yeah. And when do you expect that to be done?
Well, a lot depends on what happens once my agents start shopping it around. I would hope to have it done in 2016, but I'm new to this book publishing world. I don't really know what kind of time scale they operate on. So I would hope 2016, 2017.
I see. Okay. Well, I've had a lot of fun tonight. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it and hope we can do it again.
Yes, I'd like to have you back when you get that book published. That would be best.
All right, deal.
All right. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, have a good night.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, everyone. Well, that's it for the show this evening. And I appreciate you all listening and all the supporters out there. I appreciate all your help you're giving me. We'll get all that straightened out next week as a pre-recorded show. And on that show, I have Klaus Svahn and Dr. Eric Farouk. Kind of a sciencey show. You're going to love that one. I won't be around. I won't even be on the chat room. I'll be sleeping somewhere in Russia. And so that's it for this show. And thank you so much for listening. And you can listen the same time next week right here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.